Happy Sabbath. And it was a little longer trip than normal because a lot of construction on the interstate. It was lots of fun. So as we begin here, let's briefly look at the time of the judges in Israel's history. I'm sure most of us are keenly aware of the time of the judges. But I'd like to point out something about the word judges. The Hebrew word for judge is shofet. It can be translated as judge. It's kind of a weak translation in my opinion, because according to the Jewish encyclopedia, the more accurate word or words for shofet is deliverer or regulator, if you will, rather than judge. But it's inadequate, wouldn't I guess? The judges we're talking of here were not legal experts. They didn't wear black robes. They didn't sit on they weren't they weren't judges as we normally would think of them. Totally lost. A courtroom. Anyway, they were chosen by God to protect, preserve, deliver, and rescue Israel from its enemies. Basically, they were chosen by God to enact his promise that he gave to Abraham. The book of Judges lists 12 leaders, talking about the book of Judges, whom God raised up to deliver Israel between the days of Joshua and then of the kings, Saul, of King Saul and then David. Yet scripture also calls Eli and Samuel judges as well, bringing the total to 14, if you're counting. And both counts are accurate. God empowered these judges to protect his people, to preserve his nation, and deliver Israel from its enemies. These judges were 13 men and one woman, Deborah. They were not kings, as I said, but they were leaders raised up by God in times of crisis. This period spans about 350 years and follows a familiar cycle that we may recognize even today as one of rebellion, punishment, repentance, if you will, or something that might resemble that regarding them, and then deliverance. And after that generation, repeat the cycle again. Two of these judges, Gideon and Samson, are even mentioned in Hebrews 11. And I would say they are among the most bizarre and fascinating and unusual characters in the Bible. So the title of this message is, if you're writing this down, the title is From Wine Press to Pillars, Weakness, Strength, and the Power of God. Gideon and Samson lived generations apart, yet they share something very vital. Both were deeply flawed men whose faith was not initially aligned with God's will. It's kind of like a car out of alignment. I don't know if you've ever had one of those. It would never track true. It's basically going to the left or right, never according to my will, where I want it to go. It's going to go off in its own direction, right? So we'll begin with Gideon's story, and then we'll move on to Samson's story. So if you have your Bibles, go ahead and we'll just jump over to Judges. We'll start around Judges 6. And basically, through this split, I'm just going to highlight the stories of these two men with the hope that we will go back and read their stories in full in our own time. So I lost my place. So like the two men were basically out of alignment with God's will. Judges 21, verse 25 gives a very good overview of what was going on at that time. I'm just going to quote it. It says, in those days, verse 25 of Judges 21, it says, in those days there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in their own eyes. For 7 years, Israel lived under relentless attacks from the Midianites and the Amalekites. You read that in Judges 6, verse 3. They were oftentimes would have to hide in the mountains and the caves just to save their own skins. And finally, they cry out to the Lord for deliverance. So in Judges 6:11, help comes. An angel of the Lord appeared. Now I'm going to quote from our UCG's own commentary that we have regarding this angel of the Lord. Quote, this who seems to have been the Lord himself in this case, compare verses 12, 14, 16, and 23 of the same chapter of Judges 6, i.e. the pre-incarnate Christ as messenger of the Father. And you can also compare Genesis 16, 10 through 13. So what we have here is this angel of the Lord is basically the Word, the pre-incarnate, the pre-Christ, as a messenger of the Father. So God selects a man named Gideon to be the answer, to deliver Israel from the Midianites and the Amalekites to some smaller degree. And the angel of the Lord, the Word, appears to Gideon in a really bizarre place. It's a wine press of all things. Gideon is hiding in a wine press. He's threshing wheat in a wine press of all things. You do not thresh wheat in a wine press. You do it on the hill so the wind can, you know, blow the chaff away. And Gideon is sifting wheat in a wine press to save it from the Midianites out of sight and, in, to be very clear, out of fear of the Midianites. So the angel of the Lord appeared to him as a man with Gideon in this wine press. I got to tell you, that image there is kind of funny to me. he's winnowing wheat in this wine press, and all of a sudden this angel appears. It's I don't know why I'm thinking that's funny, but I think it's funny. I'm sure. If you're ready for a little sarcasm, the angel of the Lord in chapter 6:12, verse 12, said to Gideon, the Lord is with you, you mighty man of valor. Could you imagine Gideon like, yeah, right, no, that's not me. I am not a mighty man of valor. Gideon was a coward. He was hiding in a wine press, winnowing wheat in fear. And verse 13, the first thing that Gideon says to the angel is what? He says, where have you been? We know of all the great things that you've done for our fathers of Israel. I mean, why is all this happening to us? And I guarantee you the angel is probably like, come on, man. Don't you know? And then Gideon said, my clan is the weakest, and I am the weakest in my clan. Why are you calling me? And in verse 16, and the Lord said, surely I will be with you, and you shall defeat the Midianites as one man, as one unit. Gideon's lack of faith is on full display right here, and he starts demanding signs from God, and we know the story. So Gideon runs. He offers unleavened bread and meat to the angel of the Lord. So the angel of the Lord instructs Gideon to place the food on this big rock, and then all of a sudden the angel touches the rock with his rod, and is completely consumed in fire. And then poof, he's gone. The angel just disappears. And verses 22 and 23 shows us that Gideon is starting to finally get it. He finally starts to get it. And in verse 23, the quote says, then the Lord said to him, peace be with you. Do not fear. You shall not die. Because they all knew, if you saw God's presence, you're probably not going to live through that. So God is giving him peace and assurance that you're going to be okay. Now, regarding this whole incident with the rock and the food, Matthew Henry's concise commentary states, the angel turned the meat into an offering made by fire. Hereby, a sign was given to Gideon that he had found grace in God's sight. He found grace in God's sight. And then comes the real issue, if you're ready. It's idolatry. Idolatry in verses 25, still same chapter 6, 25 and 26, if you're following along. God commands him to tear down his father's idols to Baal. Gideon obeys. He does. But he does it sheepishly. He does it at night out of fear of his father's household, out of his fear of his dad, out of fear of man. His obedience is real. It is. But it's hesitant and marked by reluctance rather than bold faith. And that's the point. Gideon was more afraid of man than he was of God. And as long as idolatry remained, the attacks would still continue. So what is idolatry? I think we were all pretty well aware of it, but I'm just going to rehearse it here. Idolatry, what is idolatry and why is it so offensive to God? You know, idolatry isn't just ancient statues. It's anything that replaces God as our source of security, hope, and identity. And it's just as present in our world as it was back then. Probably more so. Idolatry essentially turns the creator-created relationship completely upside down. It's portrayed as spiritual adultery, a betrayal of God's covenant, and leading to sin and destruction. To be clear, as long as idolatry remains in every one of us, alignment with God's will is never possible. So now Gideon starts to obey, and the pagan altar is gone. And finally, his faith begins to be aligned with God. Not completely there yet, but it's starting to be in line with God's will. And when the enemy returns, Gideon finally calls Israel to fight. He's starting to get it. He calls Israel to fight. And now Gideon is taking on the responsibility of leadership by telling them that they need to fight. So Gideon removes the corrupting idols, and by doing so, he begins to place his faith where it truly belongs. Not in false gods, but in the true God. In this act of obedience, God is realigning Gideon's faith. So 32,000 men respond to Gideon's call. 32,000 men. And Gideon is still afraid. He's still afraid. I'm sorry, but he's a coward. It's still now. And look, it's still in verse 36 and through 40. You can read along later. He asks for more signs. We all know the story of the fleece. Remember? He did twice. He said, you know, let the fleece be full of dew and the ground be wet and vice versa. And God said to Gideon, you will be patient. You will be victorious over the Midianites. And they will flee as one unit. God was still patient with him. He didn't just give up on him. Like, oh, you're hopeless, Gideon. But God is gracious. But God graciously gives him the signs of the fleece twice. And Gideon's faith is strengthened, albeit for just a moment. So Gideon collects his army of 32,000 men to face the Midianites. Gideon, once a farmer, was now called to lead an entire army. Yet God had a different plan for the coming battle. We know the story. Now in chapter 7, verses 2 and 4, 32,000 men gathered to fight. But God says, you know what? I don't think so. That's way too many. Way too many. So God reduces the army down to 10,000 guys. You can go ahead and you can read along later. And then the unthinkable happens in Gideon's mind. God reduces the army down to just 300 men. Gideon must have been like, come on, man. I had 32,000 guys. Now I've got 300. Are you seriously? Gideon is incredibly in despair and distraught over 300 men that he's got to work with. And why? It's because God wanted Gideon to know that it's not by your power. It is only by my will and my power that you're going to have this victory over the Midianites. So God gives him another sign. He asks for another sign and to calm his cowardly nerves. Now, God, this is actually a bold thing that Gideon did in my mind. God tells Gideon to sneak into the Midianite army. So he did at night, and he hears this very incredible thing that God's asking of this fearful farmer, if you will. But he obeys, and he overhears a dream being interpreted by the enemy, by the Midianites. And it was interpreted as Israel's victory over the Midianites. Strengthened by this, Gideon returns to camp and finally begins to truly believe that God will deliver Midian into his hand. Gideon's men are divided into three companies of 100. And their weapons, are you ready? They get to have a torch, an empty pitcher, and a trumpet, a clay pitcher, a pot, if you will. They probably had a sword as well, but that's what they initially had. So they surround the Midianite camp at night and on the hills above them, and they start blowing the trumpets, smashing the pitchers to the ground, and holding up the torches and shouting, "The sword of the Lord and of Gideon." The Midianites believe that every torch is the head of a battalion of men. They are stricken with panic and fear. It is pitch black, and all they see is thousands of men about to slaughter them. They panic, and they begin to actually destroy themselves. And chapter 7 and 8 describe the chase. As a result of this, the people of Israel wanted to make Gideon their king. And what did Gideon say? "The Lord is our king. It is his glory that we have this victory, and only his glory." Judges 8:28, the last part of the verse, "And the country was quiet for 40 years in the days of Gideon." It's a testimony to what God can do through human weakness that is finally yielded to him. But what happens when great strength is not matched with obedience? Well, that question brings us to Samson. Samson, who is a man remembered for extraordinary power and yet marked by personal weakness or problems. Some commentators say that he was the original superhero. I don't really know about that. But Samson's story begins much like Gideon's. An angel of the Lord appears, food is offered, and then the offering is miraculously consumed by fire. And then the angel ascends in the smoke and is gone. Yet their personalities could not be more different. They're absolutely, completely, utterly different. Gideon saw himself as weak and inadequate and unusable. Samson, on the other hand, saw himself as incredibly strong, invincible, brash, and reckless. In Judges 13, Israel is once again under Philistine oppression. Once again, God's judgment because of their sin. And Samson was to live, as just a quick note here, Samson was born into a Nazarite vow for life. It was a lifelong vow that God inspired his family to put him under. So this means he could have no alcohol, no cutting of his hair, and no contact with dead bodies. This vow symbolized separation and holiness. Yet Samson violated all three of them. He did. He touched a dead body. He drank at a wedding feast. And he eventually allowed his hair to be cut, breaking his Nazarite vow. He lived by fleshly desires, especially for Philistine women, with a violent temper and with little regard, almost no regard to God's law whatsoever. His life became a legendary tragedy. Still, God had a purpose for him. And at key moments, the Spirit of the Lord came upon Samson, giving him incredible supernatural strength, which was always used against the Philistines. Always. He burns fields, strikes down armies, kills 1,000 men with a donkey's jawbone, of all things. But his life is unstable. His life is completely unstable, driven by anger, desire, lust, and pride. In chapter 15, verse 16, after boasting in his victory and singing a song about himself to himself, he is at the point of death, complete dehydration. He is about to die. He is at death's door. And then finally, in that complete exhaustion, he acknowledges the truth. He finally acknowledges that God gave him the deliverance. It didn't come by him. He realizes, God, you did this. So God responds. He provides water from a rock, saving his life. And in the end, even through a deeply flawed man, God's power and purpose still prevails. But after all of that, there is a recognition that, God, you did this. You did this. Samson finally realized the truth. And in verse 20, he judged Israel for 20 years. For 20 years, he delivered Israel for 20 years in the days of the Philistines. The Lord delivered him from life-threatening dehydration. And for the first time, he was weak. And there were no Philistines around. God only gave him his greatest power when he faced them. So for two decades, Israel was given rest from the Philistines. But Israel would be troubled by them again. Maybe they would. And at Samson's death, he would strike them with a mighty blow. We know the story of Delilah, right? We know the story. And in the final chapter, Samson does what he does, unfortunately. He starts lusting after Philistine women again. And in chapter 16, verses 1 and 3, 1 through 3, it's embarrassing to say, but he first visits a prostitute in Gaza, of all things. And the Philistines find out. They know where he is now. Remember, he had been protecting Israel for 20 years now. So they try to capture him. They come up with a plot to capture him. The Spirit of the Lord comes upon him again. He uproots the gates of the city and carries them on his shoulders 38 miles away to the hills of Hebron. That's amazing, just even thinking about that. He then fixes lust upon Delilah. And disaster is inevitable. It is evident that disaster is coming. So the plot now to bring Samson down is on. Delilah eventually manipulates him to give her the source of his strength. Chapter 16, 8 through 17. So the Philistines arrive, and he no longer has his hair. He is completely unaware that God has departed from him. He didn't know that the sin of his life had reached a turning point with God by this time. Long blinded by might, long blinded by arrogance, and long blinded by lust. The Philistines give the credit to their god Dagon for Samson's capture. And now they have a mighty feast in the temple to celebrate that Dagon has defeated this mighty Samson. The festivities escalate, and they demand to see this man that Dagon defeated. Chapter 16, verse 25. They bring him in. Samson asks to be placed between the pillars to steady himself. So in chapter 16, 27 through 28, Samson asks for strength from God one last time. In one last climactic, sacrificial, heroic act, a broken, repentant man asks for strength one last time. Even at this time, Samson wanted personal vengeance for what they did to his eyes. But now there was something larger in his heart. Because now he was willing to give up his life to protect his people, God's people, from God's enemies. God gave him the power to push those pillars apart, killing 3,000 Palestinians and himself. Samson died repentant, broken, and humble. He died for the cause of his nation and his God. His God said to remove the Palestinians of the Philistines from the land, but Israel had not done it. In a final act of faith, he cries out to God, to be an instrument of God, to do the will of God, and destroy the enemies of God. And God heard his prayer. Two men, completely opposite extremes. One had weak faith, corrupted by fear and idolatry. Yet when God realigned him, he became strong. The other had incredible strength, but his faith was corrupted by it. His faith was corrupted by his own power. He became weak, and in one final act of faith, God made him strong one last time. You know, God uses all kinds of people. He takes the weak and makes them strong. He lifts the humble, the fearful, even the timid, empowering them through faith. And he humbles the strong, he humbles the bold, the self-reliant, bringing them into alignment with his will. Hebrews says, out of weakness they were made strong. So when we look at our lives, or even the church itself, and wonder, why can God use us in our weakness? Yes, he can. He absolutely can, and he will. When we look in the mirror, remember, God uses flawed people. That's the only thing he has to work with, right? Paul understood this deeply. In deep suffering, he pleaded three times for relief, but God answered, "My grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness." And Paul concluded, "When I am weak, then I am strong." That's the key, isn't it? That's the key. But only when we see our weakness can we truly become strong in God, in the Lord. Gideon was weak, weak enough to become mighty in God. Samson was strong until his strength failed, forcing him to fully depend on God one last time. And there in weakness came his greatest act of faith. History shows the same pattern over and over again. When we are brought low, we are often finally ready to truly, truly rely on God. And the church must hear this. We must. There are times when we can become strong and even proud of that strength, self-reliant, confident in our own accomplishments. Sound familiar? Back in the day? Yes, the church was once mighty in numbers. We had over 140 plus thousand. Maybe God had to weaken us so he could do a mighty work through us. One last time. But that's dangerous ground. Because the real issue is not whether we are weak or strong, large or small. It is whether our faith is aligned with God's will only. Gideon shows us that when fear, doubt, pride, and even hidden idolatry are surrendered, God can use what seems insignificant to accomplish overwhelming victory. Samson reminds us that strength apart from God leads to blindness and bondage. But even then, when pride is broken and repentance is real, God can still write a final chapter in every one of us. Both men are in Hebrews 11. Not because they were flawless, but because they learned at critical moments to trust God more than man or themselves. And that same God is working with us today. Just like Gideon and Samson, God will not give up on you, and God will not give up on his church. He is not looking for our self-confidence, our numbers as a church or whatever, or our past accomplishments. He is looking for obedience, for humility, and surrender. When we stop relying on our own strength, are despairing over our weakness or as a church or personally, and finally trust in him, his power will be revealed in us individually and as a church. So wherever you are, whether you're hiding in a wine press or standing too confidently and your own strength. Hear this clearly. God is not finished with you. God doesn't force these things from us. But He does call us to, or He does call us to release or let go of whatever is competing with Him in our minds. To humble the heart, to let go of fear, and to trust Him more deeply. Because it is still true today. Out of weakness, they were made strong. So let us walk forward, not in fear, not in arrogance, but in faithful alignment with God. And when He acts, and I guarantee you He will, all the glory will belong to Him and to Him alone.